If there's one thing the American people and their politicians agree on, it's this. The nation's infrastructure is crumbling. So President Biden has unveiled his plan to turn things around.
The American Jobs Plan will modernize 20,000 miles of highways, roads, and main streets.
He wants bipartisan support.
10,000 bridges, desperately needed upgrades to unclog traffic, keep people safe.
Says he's willing to negotiate.
New rail corridors and transit lines, easing congestion, cutting pollution, slashing commute time.
He promises an economic renaissance and a healthier, safer America.
American Jobs Plan will put plumbers and pipe fitters to work, replacing 100% of the nation's lead pipes and service lines.
Now, it'll cost $2 trillion. So how does President Biden hope to raise all that cash? By raising taxes on corporate America.
We're going to raise the corporate tax. It was 35%, which is too high. We all agreed 5 years ago it should go down to 28%, but they reduced it to 21%. We're going to raise it back to up to 28%. No one should be able to complain about that. It's still lower than what that rate was between World War II and 2017. Just doing that one thing will generate $1 trillion in additional revenue over 15 years.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And while the president might say no one should be able to complain about that, he's getting a lot of pushback already, specifically from corners who say raising the corporate tax would make America less competitive. So today we're going to take a step back and look at that big question. What does making America competitive really mean? And we'll start today in Hanover, New Hampshire, with Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so give us your big take here on Biden's bold move on how he wants to pay for his massive infrastructure plan.
Well, essentially, he tries to undo or reform a feature of one of the worst pieces of tax legislation passed in my lifetime. That would be the 2017 Trump mostly corporate tax cut. There was also a personal tax cut. What was wrong with that? Well, it in terms of its ostensible goals, it met none of them. Of course, its real goals were elsewhere. What were the ostensible goals? Well, President Trump said it'll cost me a fortune. Estimates are that the Trump family could net between $11 million and $22 million a year from the tax cut, and that the commercial real estate industry benefited enormously from features in it. Another claim was that it would pay for itself. Wrong. It's going to add $1.9 trillion to the national debt. A further claim, it would boost economic growth. Wrong. Economic growth grew the same the 2 years before the tax cut and as it did the 2 years after. Another claim, it would boost investments. Corporations would take this cornucopia open to them and pour it into new plant and equipment. No, Brookings Institute, no evidence that the Trump tax cut boosted investment. Number four, the claim was that this new investment would trickle down to workers because they'd be more productive with all the new plant and equipment. But because there was not any new investment to speak of, the wage gains, which the White House claimed could be between $4,000 per family to $9,000 per family over 3 to 5 years, those never came to pass. According to the Congressional Research Service, quote, very little growth in wage rates. And finally, there was another claim that the changes in the international taxation system would prevent companies from or would discourage companies from moving abroad on the one hand and investing abroad. In fact, there's some evidence that it had a contrary effect, that it actually increased some investment abroad. So if the corporations didn't invest in plant and equipment, if none of those things happened, what do they do with it? Well, they engaged in an orgy of stock buybacks. In the first year, according to one estimate, $929 billion of the tax cut from corporations went to stock buybacks. $7 billion went to wage increases. And, of course, stock buybacks, what's the incentives for those? Well, they increase the value of CEOs' salaries, since those are tied to stock price, and stock buybacks increase the value of stock, which greatly benefits the CEO and the richest, the largest stockholders, who are almost always pretty well-off people. So it failed in almost every claim made for it has not borne out. And then I said, these were the ostensible claims. The real reason, I think, was put pretty well by, and the reporting at the time makes it out, one politician, a Republican, said, "My donors are basically saying, get it done or don't ever call me again." And, of course, Senator Jubilation T. Cornpone, a.k.a. Lindsey Graham, he said, quote, "If Congress didn't pass this bill, the financial contributions will stop." And there's strong evidence that the main motive for this bill, and it succeeded there, was to increase the corporation donations to the Republican Party. So changing this law, quite apart from what you're going to use it for, is probably good public policy in its own right, because none of the claims have been borne out. Inequality has increased. And the average American has gained little or nothing. I guess there are about $1,000 in personal tax cuts, but those have been almost eaten up by the $800 estimate in the Trump tariffs have caused. So changing this law, quite apart from how you're going to use the money, is a desirable public policy goal.
So that's the big question, right? How do we fund a healthy, functioning 21st century America, right? Like, what is the mix of revenue sources for good governance, functioning infrastructure, a healthy economy? And obviously, there's differences of opinion on that, Jack. For example, on Monday, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was in Lexington, Kentucky, and here's what he said he thinks of the president's plan to increase the corporate tax rate.
I can't imagine myself, if that's the package, a bunch of more borrowed money plus undoing the tax relief that drove our economy to 50-year high, I can't imagine that's going to be very appealing to many Republicans. Infrastructure, however, is appealing, and if we can figure a way to do it paid for, I'd be open to it, but not what I think they're peddling.
So, Jack, just very briefly, if you could, your response to McConnell.
Well, the argument that he's in favor of the goal. Oh, yes, I want infrastructure improvement. I just don't want corporations to have to pay for it. Well, then who should pay for it? You know, according to polls, there was one poll in 2016, 67% of Americans think corporations pay too little. That was before the Trump tax cut. And, of course, the Biden proposed increase would not be all the way up to 35%. Those dark days when corporations were struggling under the burden of this usurious tax cut. No. There would tax burden. No, it would only go up to 28%. And if President Manchin has its way, it would really stop at 25%. So it's just hard to see how that's an argument that makes any sense. Does he want the gas tax to go up? Ordinary people to pay for the infrastructure?
Well, interesting. What always fascinates me about these conversations regarding taxation is we've, in a sense, been through all of this before. So listen with me for a second, Jack, because Joe Thorndike is a contributing editor at the nonprofit news service Tax Notes. He's a historian of corporate taxation. There is an expert for everything. I love this. He says that the issues we're dealing with today are nothing new.
Basically, when we're talking about the corporate income tax, we've been dealing with a lot of the same problems for about 100 years. And what's remarkable to me is that many of these problems are no more resolved now than they were 100 years ago.
And unresolved problems like what tax rate to set and what that means for corporations, those are some examples in terms of how they have an impact on the national economy.
My general take on taxes and the economy is that they're not as dangerous to the economy as conservatives would like you to believe nor are they as innocuous as liberals want you to think. I mean, I hate to just be a sort of pox on both your houses thing, but it is overstated on both sides of the equation. But what we can say is that after World War II, we had high corporate tax rates. The corporate tax rate was, the top rate was at better than 40%. It topped out at 52% starting in 1952. And the economy was roaring. Now, if I'm a conservative, I look back at that and I say, well, of course it was, because the rest of the world was in ruins after World War II and America stood astride the world without real competition. We could afford to have high tax rates, as opposed to now, when we're competing really hard against countries all around the world. We can't afford high tax rates. Pretty reasonable point also.
The history of corporate tax rates is like a hump, he says. 1909, 1%. World War I, 12%. World War II, 40%. And then that 52% in the middle of the 20th century under Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
So that's the top of the hump, right? And then it starts to decline. And those rates continue to fall, 1960, 1970, up to 1980. And then they stabilize around in the 1990s.
Corporate tax laws are a thicket of numbers and rules. But Thorndike says don't get tangled up in the numbers and rules if you really want to figure out how much corporations should contribute to the nation's coffers.
Tax is ultimately a political issue. Don't let the economists fool you. It's not about efficiency. It's ultimately tax debates in this country. And I'd say this with a complete confidence as a tax historian. Tax debates in this country turn on questions of fairness. And fairness is a political issue that's hashed out at the voting booth.
Joe Thorndike is a contributing editor at the nonprofit news service Tax Notes and a corporate tax historian walking us through some of the history of corporate taxation in this country. Well, Jack Beattie, stand by as we take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll do what Thorndike says. We're actually going to hash some of this out on the level of economic and political analysis. And hop over to social media, by the way, Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio, and let us know what you think about President Biden's proposal to raise the nominal corporate tax rate in this country to fund infrastructure. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we are exploring President Biden's proposal to increase the corporate tax rate in order to pay for his massive infrastructure bill, the $2 trillion proposal that he has recently put out. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. And let me bring into the conversation a couple of other folks now. Jason Furman joins us. He's former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under President Obama. He was President Obama's top economic advisor for both his terms in office. And he's now a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you.
Also joining us is Pam Olson. She served as Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy at the U.S. Department of the Treasury as the department's top tax official from 2002 to 2004 under President George W. Bush, former partner as well at the accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, or PwC. Pam Olson, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So as much as I thrill to the idea of parsing through the nitty-gritty of President Biden's tax proposal, which we will in just a second, I actually want to reframe this conversation a little bit to this bigger, deeper question of really what will it take? What shape should a truly competitive United States What shape should the economy take to make the United States truly competitive in the 21st century? What does competitiveness actually mean? And in order to set that up, let me offer you two different views of that. First of all, here's U.S. Chamber of Commerce Executive Vice President Neil Bradley. He was on Fox Business just last week, and he says the business community wants to negotiate with the White House about that corporate tax, the proposed corporate tax increase. And then he stated his primary concern with Biden's plan as it stands now.
Infrastructure is the most popular idea that seems to never get done. But when it comes to the pay-fors, you may be able to pay for this with the massive tax increases that have been proposed, but they're going to make U.S. companies much less competitive. It will make the American tax code less competitive than it was internationally, even during the Obama administration. And all of that means fewer American jobs.
Now, on Monday, speaking to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen raised a different viewpoint, a different definition of what she believes competitiveness means in the 21st century.
Competitiveness is about more than how U.S. headquartered companies fare against other companies in global merger and acquisition bids. It's about making sure that governments have stable tax systems that raise sufficient revenue to invest in essential public goods and respond to crises, and that all citizens fairly share the burden of financing government.
So Jason Furman and Pam Olson and Jack Beattie, and Jason, I'll start with you. Your analysis, your judgment on Janet Yellen's definition of competitiveness for today.
Yeah, Meghna, I think Secretary Yellen has it basically right. Competitiveness, economists prefer the word productivity or productive. It's how much people can make per hour. And that depends on a lot of things. You need ports. You need great education. You need to include people who have otherwise been marginalized so that they can make the best contributions to the U.S. economy. And yes, I do think the tax system is relevant. While debates over the tax system are primarily political, that doesn't mean we shouldn't think about the economics of it. And that's why you wouldn't want a corporate tax rate of 99%. But we'll come back to, I think, the Biden proposal is quite reasonable in historical, comparative, and economic perspective.
Mm. And Pam, I mean, Yellen's pretty specific here. I mean, she says it's more than just where companies are, or U.S. companies headquartered here, how they fare in terms of, I guess, profits and even number of jobs. Your analysis of that?
Well, I'd say first that the reference to M&A is just a straw man argument and doesn't really have anything to do with the debate. I do think it matters whether or not the U.S. headquartered companies are competitive, are able to. So if you have too high a tax rate, what you do is you put a discount on the assets held by American companies. They're more valuable in the hands of somebody else. I think it matters whether or not we have U.S. headquartered companies. And I think most business people think it matters whether or not we have U.S. headquartered companies. So I don't think we want a system that means that U.S. companies are acquired by foreign companies on a regular basis. So we need to focus on that. But, you know, the thing that matters most is, you know, it was the headline on the Senate Finance Committee hearing a couple of weeks ago. We want policy that's good for American workers, jobs, and investment. And that's where we've got to put our focus. And absolutely, that means that we need infrastructure. That means that we need to invest in our people. We need to improve our education. We need to do all of those things. We need to make sure that we're taking care of the disadvantaged. And then the question comes back to, how do we best fund that? Mm-hmm. And the corporate income tax, I think, is popular because it's there's an old line from Senator Russell Long, don't tax me, don't tax thee, tax the fellow behind the tree. And the corporation is the fellow behind the tree because nobody really understands how it's taxed or what the impact is. And so we go to the corporation and say the corporation should pay more in tax. It is a political decision, but we should use what we know about economics and about how business responds to things to do the best job of shaping our tax policy and raising the amount of revenue that we need to build the kind of society that we want.
But isn't it true, though? I mean, the person behind the tree, if we continue on with that that analogy there, if we allow ourselves to presume that that person is corporations right now, that what is it at this moment? 7% of federal revenues comes from corporate taxation. More than half or around half of it comes from individual income taxes. But that 7% from corporations is a shadow of what it once was. So, I mean, we actually know we have factual data that the amount of federal revenue from corporations has gone down significantly, across the 20th century.
Actually, that's not right. I mean, if we go way back, we go back before 1980, which I know Jason has some charts that he's shown that show how much higher it was. But we've also got a very different economy today than we did back then. If we look at it in more recent years, like the last 40 years, say, what you find is that corporate receipts have stayed fairly constant. And that's despite a drop in the tax rate. And the reason it's despite a drop in the tax rate is because the base to which the tax is applied has increased. That's happened every time that we've done a reduction in the rate. We've expanded the base. So we end up collecting a fairly similar amount in corporate tax.
Jason, you want to respond to that?
Yeah. You know, if you look, the United States has a statutory rate, an official rate of 21%. There's also state-level taxes, so that gets the total to 26. That's actually lower than the tax rate that you have in Canada, Italy, Japan, Germany, and France, five of the other G7 economies. The only G7 economy with a lower statutory tax rate than the United States is the United Kingdom. And guess what? They're proposing to raise theirs. Their conservative government has proposed to increase their corporate tax rate to roughly where the U.S. one is now. Moreover, those rates that I just told you about, that's the official rate.
Mm-hmm.
That's the statutory rate that's written into the legislation. If you look at what companies actually pay, it's less than that. From an economic perspective, the relevant concept, and all of my friends in economics from across the political spectrum would agree, is something called the effective, so that's in practice, marginal, because this is what affects your decisions, tax rate. The effective marginal tax rate that American companies face is 11%. That's quite low. And so I think if you look at where tax rates have been in the past, you look at where tax rates are in other countries, there is room to raise them on corporations in the United States today. Now, I wouldn't go back. I agree with Pam. The economy has changed. The economy is different. The world has moved on. I would not go back to the 35% rate that we had before President Trump. But going back to 28% is actually pretty close to what the business community itself was asking for in 2017. It would be reasonable in light of where other countries are. And importantly, it would be part of a shift in the way other countries tax, away from the trend of the race to the bottom we've had for decades, the United States helping arrest that trend and move it in the opposite direction. Mm.
So can I just want to, just a point of clarification here, because we can do this analysis, we can do this analysis from the difference between the nominal and the effective tax rates, point really taken. Pam, I also hear you in terms of the expansion of the overall tax base, which then leads to a greater like the actual physical number of dollars going into federal coffers. But the number I want to drive at is the percentage of federal revenue that is brought in through corporate taxation, right? So that should take into account the difference between nominal versus effective, and it should take into account the increased tax base, right? So right now, is it not true, Jason, that the percent of federal revenue coming in from corporations to the United States government is about 7% of our total federal revenue?
Yes.
And how much lower is that than what it has been before?
Right. That's a decent amount lower. I think that might be the lowest it's been. Partly it's that some companies are paying taxes not through the corporate system, but they're paying through the individual system, which itself often raises a host of problems. But it's also because, especially with regards to international things, companies are getting better and better at saying that they earned their profits overseas, whether or not they actually did, and avoiding paying taxes. And one of the things that the Biden proposal is that 7%, that would go up, wouldn't go up a huge amount. It wouldn't be a whole lot higher than it's been over the last couple decades. It would just restore it a little bit to the against the reductions that we've seen.
And so, Pam Olson, let me turn back to you then. Do you think that, again, keeping with this lens of creating a competitive economy for the United States, that percent of federal revenue from corporations should go up a little? What's the right amount?
I don't know what the right amount is, but if we go back to those, you know, again, what we want is not just a fair share of tax burden being borne, but economically, we want more investment in the United States. That's what's going to generate more jobs here in the United States, is going to build a stronger economy, create more opportunities, rising wages, all of those great things that I think people of all political stripes want. And so the what we have to make sure is that we have a rate that will attract that kind of investment here in the United States rather than abroad. And if we look at that, as Jason mentioned, about 26% in the U.S., taking into account federal and state and local, where that puts us on the OECD chart is at the high end of the pack. Yes, we are below a few countries, but one of the countries he mentioned was France. France is about to lower its rate to 25%. When the U.K. increases its rate to 25%, they'll both still be below the United States. So are there a few higher than us? Yes, there are. But if we go to President Biden's 28%, then where we're going to be is back in number one position at the OECD. That's not a recipe for attracting investment in the United States. Even if we stop at something closer to the middle, say 25%, we're still going to be very much at the high end with respect to the OECD. On effective average tax rates, again, we're above the OECD average. And the same thing if we looked at the marginal rates, we are above the OECD average. So what we want is a system that will attract investment into the United States. I don't know what the magic number is, but right now we're slightly above the rest of the pack. We are no longer the number one place for foreign direct investment. China took that spot in 2020. So we need to really make sure that we're focusing on creating a system that will attract investment, because that's what's going to create jobs. That's what's going to create rising wages. That's what's going to provide more opportunities for Americans and for us to build the kind of society we want.
Jack, you've been listening in. You want to share some thoughts here?
Well, I have actually a question for our economist. How does Secretary Yellen's proposal for an international minimum corporate tax fit into this? I mean, she argues that would prevent, or at least mitigate, the race to the bottom, the kind of, you know, arbitrage between going to the, investing in the company in the country with the lowest rates. Doesn't that sort of firm up the argument that even a slightly higher rate here will not be so deleterious, since there's going to be an international agreement about setting rates? Any response to that?
Yeah, I agree that's a very important point. I wouldn't, first of all, compare the U.S. tax rate to all the OECD countries. That includes countries like Latvia and Lithuania. Those are really small countries. They have a strategy of having low tax rates in order to attract companies. The United States has a strategy of being a great economy with educated workers, great infrastructure, and a key market. That's why we have companies, not because of some type of tax competition that you see in a small country. So I'd compare us to larger countries. And then, yes, if you have an effective international system, you can drive some wedge between your tax rates and tax rates in other countries. Pam's right, under the Biden plan, we'd be towards the upper end in terms of tax rates. We'd go from the lower end to the upper end. But that would work because there would be, you know, if you moved overseas, you would still have to pay taxes in the United States. They have this proposal for a 21% minimum tax rate. If you go to Germany and they have a higher rate than that, you don't need to pay that minimum tax rate. So it does not interfere with a company's ability to do real business. But if you go to a tax haven and you pretend you're there, pretend all your profits are there, you're still going to have to pay 21% back to the United States. And so this proposal would allow us to have a different tax rate than other countries. Moreover, we'd be doing a lot to encourage and create incentives for other countries to adopt this minimum tax rate.
Jason, go ahead and finish your thought. And then, Pam, when we come back from our break, I'll let you respond too. But, Jason, you got about 30 seconds before our break.
Yeah, the international corporate tax discussion is just very different today than it's been for the last several decades. For the last several decades, all the pressure has been rates going down and let's not tax income overseas. Now there's a global conversation about how to stop that race to the bottom and start collecting corporate revenue. The United States is moving from a laggard in the discussion to a leader in that discussion.
Well, Jason Furman and Pam Olson and Jack Beattie, hang on here. We'll come back from the break and talk more about this global minimum tax rate proposal, because it is being discussed right now, in fact, today, amongst international leaders in Europe. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about rising rates of infertility in this country. And there seems to be a pattern in Western nations, a decades-long decline in sperm count. And so we're going to talk to a researcher who wonders if we're on the way to a fertility crisis. And we want to know if this is something that you have struggled with, if you've struggled with infertility. We want to hear your story. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking about President Joe Biden's big plan to rebuild America's infrastructure, and at the core of that plan, how to pay for it. He's proposing an increase in the nominal corporate tax rate in this country. But really, the deeper question is, what will it take to make a competitive economy in the United States for the 21st century? What does competitiveness really mean, and how do we get there? I'm joined today by Jason Furman. He served as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama. Pam Olson is with us. She served as assistant secretary for tax policy at the Treasury under President George W. Bush. And Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, is with us as well. And Pam, I just want to hear a little bit from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on this issue of the idea of the global minimum corporate tax rate, which is being discussed by the OECD and the G20, currently at work on a potential deal. And they could maybe have something done by the summer. But here's Yellen.
We're working with G20 nations to agree to a global minimum corporate tax rate that can stop the race to the bottom. Together, we can use a global minimum tax to make sure the global economy thrives based on a more level playing field in the taxation of multinational corporations.
Pam Olson, your thoughts about that, especially as Yellen identifies what she calls the race to the bottom, the global race to the bottom on taxation rates.
Sure. So the first thing I'm going to do is say that there isn't a global race to the bottom. That is more hyperbole than fact. There has been a dramatic reduction in corporate rates from 1980 to 2020, but 90% of the rate reduction was over by 2007. So the race to the bottom, to the extent there was one, is over. It has long been a race to the middle. As Jason mentioned, the UK is coming back from 19 to 25%, or so they say. We'll see whether or not they actually implement that when the time comes. France, on the other hand, and Colombia, the two in number one and two positions of the OECD right now, are coming down. So France coming down to 25%. So there just isn't a race to the bottom. There's a race to the middle. And the U.S. was part of that effort in 2017. The idea of a global minimum tax has been around for at least 25 years. The OECD was working on a harmful tax competition project to set a global minimum tax rate back in 1996. It never went anywhere. The Obama administration, during its second term, when the OECD was working on the base erosion and profit shifting, or BEPS plan, put that concept of a global minimum tax on the table. There were no takers. So it didn't even make its way into the list of the final 15 items from the OECD. It took the United States actually enacting a minimum tax before the other OECD countries decided they were interested in it and started working on it as part of the current project on digitalization of the economy. But so this, you know, one of the important things to realize with a minimum tax is it is about secondary right to tax. So it's a right to tax income that's earned somewhere else in the United States, other than the United States, so somewhere outside of the United States. And it is, so it's going to be come in after another country has asserted primary taxing jurisdiction. To the extent that there was a failure in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and I actually think it was a remarkable bipartisan policy development achievement, it comes from the fact that the United States did try to do more to lay down a marker for what the global profits share was that it's entitled to tax. That's on the table at the OECD right now as well. It's pillar one of that conversation as opposed to pillar two. But so, you know, the global minimum tax could be useful to United States companies in setting a floor on taxation so that companies headquartered somewhere other than the United States would have to live with the same kind of rules. But we're not talking about a 21% rate. Mm-hmm. What's on the table at the OECD is something more like a 12.5% rate.
Okay.
And I don't see any indication that other governments are willing to go as high as 21%. Yeah. Setting your corporate tax rate is about sovereignty, and it's something that countries have been unwilling to give up before, and I'll be very surprised if they're willing to make that large a concession to go to a 21% minimum rate this time around.
Yeah, your sovereignty point is well taken. So we will see what happens as the year unfolds. But I'm going to keep coming back to this again. I'm going to give it one more shot here because I think that, like, we're at a moment where nationally, it's a good thing to rethink or think through again. What are the flows of revenues and where should we get them from just within the United States to build the kind of economy that we want? And I guess long-term listeners of the show will know that I get kind of stuck on certain graphs. And I am right now looking at a historic graph of shares of federal revenue, like where the money is coming from. And just after from 1945 to roughly 2019, the line for individual income tax is pretty steady. Or in the period after World War II, the share of federal revenues coming from corporate income taxes is, you know, roughly between 30 to 40%. Payroll taxes at that time is less than 10%. Today, that has flipped. It's completely flipped. We're relying far more on payroll taxes, on workers' incomes, on workers than we are on corporations for federal revenues. Now, the reason why I raise that, to bring that back to the question of how do you pay for infrastructure, is because I'm hearing corporations right now saying, well, increasing the corporate tax rate in the United States isn't the way to go. Let's do user fees. That should be part of the mix here. And I'll be perfectly honest, I spent, and we're based here in Boston. I mean, this is a national show now, but we're based in Boston. For years, I covered transportation in this city. And it has always stayed with me. This was like 10 years ago. The head of the Transit Authority here in Boston said, the MBTA, or the Transit Authority, every week brings in a million rides for workers, brings them into the city, in and out of the city, just to work in Boston every week. A million rides. And yet somehow that fact and the economic impact of that fact almost never factored into analyses of the utility or how the T was being run, the MBTA was being run. It was all about fare receipts and state income, state revenues versus how much it was costing to run the T. So we've somehow like managed to completely decouple these things. Infrastructure and business well-being, when they're actually totally very intrinsically coupled. And I don't understand why we keep looking to workers to pay the difference. I don't get it. Jason Furman, can you help explain that?
I'll try to explain it, because I don't think I 100% agree with you, so you can tell me if you agree with
Well, so let me put a finer point on the T answer. Again, you might even ride the T, Jason, here, but I never once heard state officials dare to say, we help move a million workers into the city every week to be in your offices. Maybe you guys ought to help a little bit more to keep this system running healthily.
Right. So I'd say a few things. First of all, I think it would be completely fine to do a lot of the infrastructure plan without even paying for it. So I view President Biden as having proposed two separate plans. One is for infrastructure. One is for corporate taxes. I think they're both reasonable. There are things I'd tweak in both of them. I don't think they actually need to be done together. You know, when you make an investment that's a 20-year investment, you can borrow over a 20-year period to finance it. So first of all, I don't even love the frame of you have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. The second thing I'd say is that we built the highway system from the 1950s up through President Clinton in 1993, financed by a gas tax. The gas tax, the federal gas tax, was last raised in 1993. It was raised to 18 cents a gallon, and it hasn't been raised since then. And there's been a lot of inflation since then, so that means we've effectively cut the gas tax, and we've broken the link between the people that use the highway system and the people that pay for the highway system. And I think that's a bit of a shame. If you have a higher gas tax, you'd use less gasoline, you'd have less wear and tear on the roads. You can use fees for driving in Boston, traffic fees that you have in Stockholm, London, and cities around the world can be a great way to reduce your traffic. So I think there's a lot of room for user fees. But Meghna, I agree with you. When you're setting them, you want to take into account the benefit side of the ledger for the people using that transportation and the cost side. And I'd put more of them on drivers because that's where we have more traffic problems and the like. Mm.
Jack, what do you think?
You know, I think the case for a user tax here is a strong one. The trouble is it runs into President Biden's, I think, perhaps imprudent promise that he wouldn't raise taxes, any taxes, on people earning less than $400,000 a year. A gas tax would obviously fall on everybody who drives. As I understand it, within the administration, that is one of the barriers to moving in that direction in terms of raising the gas tax. He wants to keep his promise, even because he could qualify it by saying no one's income taxes, but he hasn't. He says they won't pay a penny more in taxes. Presumably that means gas taxes, too. Mm.
And I don't want anyone to misunderstand me. I actually do believe that some kind of user fee should be part of the big mix here. But I guess, I was thinking about the economy as a whole. I mean, we're still defining users as individuals, as the people behind the wheel, Jason, mm-hmm. or buying the tickets for the train. But businesses are endpoint users here because they rely on people being able to move around, pandemic aside, for a healthy economy. I mean, Pam, you actually said this earlier that I think it was you who said it earlier that one of the things that the United States needs in order to be competitive are healthy you know, water systems, transportation systems, things like that. So by that definition, businesses are users of said systems, are they not?
Well, they are, and they obviously pay for part of that through their taxes, and then their workers are paid by them, and the workers' taxes as well as the workers' fees go to support those systems. So, I mean, it all does work through the system. I mean, you know, one of the things that's not understood, and there are lots of disagreements about it, is that the corporate income tax as well is borne in part by workers. And I think most economists agree that at least some share of the corporate income tax is borne by workers, wide variation in the extent to which it's paid. But so the wages that the workers are paid should go into funding their transportation to work, however they get to work. And that means it's coming from the employer because, of course, the employer is paying the wages. So it's an indirect way of getting there, but nonetheless, it gets there. I do think we need to look at some other revenue sources, and I know that there are objections to some of the other revenue sources as being regressive. The most obvious example is a value-added tax, which could pay for a whole lot of the things that we would like to do, and it is the mechanism that every other country around the globe, or nearly every other country around the globe, has adopted to pay for the things that they want for their society to build a better society. And it's something I think we should look at. And again, I know some people object that it's regressive, but it's also a very efficient way of raising a lot of revenue. And if you take the revenues and you put that into government, that builds a more progressive system on the government side, then that can way more than offset the regressivity of the tax. So I think we need to look at some of those things. Obviously, you know, the user fees and the gas tax, as Jason mentioned, we're also concerned about the environment, climate change, and a user fee or a carbon tax, something like that, could go a long ways towards meeting some of the administration's other goals of creating a healthier planet.
Yeah. So we've just got a minute and a half left, and there's lots of listeners are wanting us to raise a really important point that has to do, Jason, with you outlined the difference between the nominal and the effective tax rates that both individuals and corporations pay. And a lot of folks are saying, well, why don't we just close the loopholes, essentially, whether or not you see them as loopholes, that allow corporations to reduce their taxable income in many cases down to zero, and then, you know, eliminate the difference between the nominal and the effective. We've just got about a minute left to go, Jason. That would take a lot of action in Congress, but is that not an important part of this story?
Right. I think some reason that effective tax rates are lower are bad, like you hide your income overseas. We should get rid of those, and the Biden proposal would get rid of a lot of those. Some of them are good. We have subsidies for research. We have subsidies for clean energy. We have expensing for business equipment, which I happen to like. And so I think it's okay if the things that are desirable lower it, but let's get rid of all the bad reasons that your effective tax rate ends up lower. And a lot of those are international.
I'm seeing in the Biden plan something snuck in there that if a company is paying zero in taxes, that there would be instead a 15% minimum tax on financial statement income. That's in the proposal too. We've just got a couple seconds. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't love that proposal. Okay. I would rather get rid of the loopholes and tax it, you know, tax what you want to tax at the rate you want to tax it, rather than have two different systems next to each other.
Well, Jason Furman, former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama, now at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And Pam Olson, who served as Assistant Secretary of Tax Policy in the Treasury under President George W. Bush, thank you as well for joining us.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much as well, Jack.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.